Welcome to A Conspiracy of Lemurs, a Regal House publishing podcast that celebrates the writing craft. Co-hosted by myself, Janie Royal, founder and editor-in-chief at Regal House Publishing, and Pam Van Dyke, Regal's marvelously talented managing editor. Today, we're delighted to continue our historical fiction podcast series with an examination of the role of truth in historical fiction. Joining us today are Regal House authors Mitchell James Kaplan and Karen Quivillon. Pam, would you please introduce our guests?
I'd be delighted. Karen Quivillon's fiction, nonfiction, and poetry has appeared in a variety of North American literary journals, including Grain Magazine, Geist Magazine, Freefall, N/Words, Obra/Artifact, The Fieldstone Review, Woventail Press, Maple Tree Literary Supplement, and many others. She is a contributor to the recent volumes When All Else Fails, Motherhood and Precarious Times, and to the League of Canadian Poets collection, Heartland, Poems for the Love of Trees. Her debut novel, The Parasol Flower, is due on shelves in August of 2020 and is available for pre-order through Regal House Publishing. Mitchell James Kaplan received his BA with honors in English literature from Yale University. His 2010 first novel, By Fire, By Water, published by Other Press, received numerous awards both domestically and abroad. He has lived in Paris and Los Angeles and currently resides in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. His novel, Into the Unbounded Night, will be released in September 2020 and is also available for pre-order through Regal House Publishing. Welcome to you both. We have a lot to talk about today.
I was hoping that both of you might consider providing our listeners with a brief synopsis of your novel so that they're aware of the time in which it's set, and perhaps a little bit on the inspiration behind its formulation. Karen, would you like to start us off?
Sure, Janie. So The Parasol Flower, there are sort of two interconnected storylines here. One is a researcher, a graduate student. The time frame for her is contemporary. So she's sort of floundering with her dissertation and comes across an old book in one of the Paris libraries. She's there for research and sort of jumps down the rabbit hole. She's interested in what's going on with a particular illustration in this book. And as coincidence would have it, she encounters it soon after in another context. And she begins to sort of quest to find out who this artist is and where she was working and whatever happened to all of her paintings. She discovers it's a woman. So that's the storyline that sort of frames the novel, as it were. And it's intermingled with the story of the artist whose work, Nancy, her name is discovering. So this artist named Hannah is working in British Malaya, the end of the 19th century. She's gone there with her husband and is painting in the jungle, which is somewhat inappropriate at the time. Her neighbors and her social circle are looking askance at that, as well as her husband. And she has asked a Sikh police officer to help her, escort her into the jungle to kind of bushwhack for her and, you know, stand guard against all the wild creatures that might be lurking as she does her painting. So that storyline is sort of what unfolds for her in terms of the boundaries that she's pushing and the art that she's creating and how she can navigate that social space to be inspired and to depict what she sees in the jungle. But also, she does also paint the local Malays and Chinese that she's living with. So it's those two stories. And it's also, I guess, in a meta level then connected to this idea of, you know, how do we recover history and what are the artifacts of history that count and those that don't? And how do we create those narratives and who gets to create them?
Fascinating questions. And we'll do our very best to approach some of them, hopefully in this podcast, which will be lots of fun. Mitchell, do you want to tell us a little bit about Into the Unbounded Night?
Sure. Well, I'd like to say, leading off of what Karen just said about her novel, that it's interesting, the contrast and the similarities with what I've been trying to do with Into the Unbounded Night. It sounds like Karen's novel is intimate, whereas mine is a very large tableau. It sounds like Karen is dealing with the subject, or one of her subjects is colonialism, and that's definitely one of the subjects of my novel. And the other point that Karen brought up that's very, very much tied in with what I'm doing is how do we create the narratives that create our sense of identity as a nation, as a people, as an ethnicity, in the context of, in my case, the first century Roman Empire. So as I said, it's a broad tableau of the first century Roman Empire, but particularly focusing on Rome, Britannia, and Judea, and the conflicts of cultures, cultural, religious, ethnic conflicts between Rome and its subjugated nations or cultures. There are, I'd say, four or five main characters. There's one character whose kind of trajectory wends its way through the entire book. That's a young lady named Aislinn, who's the sole survivor of her village in Britannia that the Romans destroy as they're invading in 43 AD. And then there's the general who led that invasion and who will later lead the Roman war in Judea, and his name is Vespasian. He becomes emperor of Rome eventually. There are two Judeans who, in very different ways, kind of live out this cultural conflict. One is a man named Yohanan. Yohanan, son of Zakkai, is a man known in Talmudic Jewish tradition, but not known outside of that prior to my writing this book, I guess. And then the other Judean character is the man known today as Saint Paul. So he's one of the founders of what we call today the Christian religion.
Thank you. Another question that occurs to me is sort of the interweaving of historical information and then fictional characters. And many historical novels choose to portray major historical events that take place off stage, if you will, while the fictional characters inhabit the world in which they occur. And I'm thinking of The Tale of Two Cities and the French Revolution. And while many writers of historical fiction utilize a number of historical figures and events within the framework of their story, often a fictional character or event can serve to tie the overall fabric together and allow a greater accessibility to contemporary readers. And I'd love it if each of you could speak to this interweaving tendency of historical fiction when it comes to incorporating fiction into the past or incorporating the past into fiction. Do you have any thoughts on that, Karen?
It sounds to me like Mitchell actually has a lot more interweaving than I have in mind. Because the way I approached it, I really was looking at history almost as a setting. So that particular place and time, as making that as rich as possible. But I wasn't really working with historical figures to any extent. So there is one character who comes sort of on screen, as it were, for I think it's one scene maybe or two. A person by the name of Frank Swettenham, who was an actual governor and leader at the time in that area. But he's really the only one who existed in real life under under that name. The historical events kind of off stage in a way. I'm mostly working with people who wouldn't have made it into the official historical record. That said, the intermingling is really also around for me, I suppose, what would have been in place at the time in terms of, you know, customs, laws, everything about that place, as opposed to the particular people.
Right. It is amazing, too, to your point, the role to which environment takes on the role of a character, really, and thinking about the sort of lush humidity in the tropical environment in which your historic character is set, Hannah. The environment really becomes a historic character in of themselves in a way.
Yes, yes, very much, I think. But I work that way in other things that I write that are not necessarily placed in a historical era. It may be, so for instance, in travel writing, it's very similar, but you're evoking setting almost as another character, right? So that was my approach, was if I'm going to be here in this place and time, it's going to be vividly as it was to that extent. And then from there, with the character and the plot and storyline, I departed, of course, and had to just make things up as I went.
That's the fun part of the fiction, isn't it? Making things up. Mitchell, would you like to speak to the same?
Sure. There are real events, as far as we know, that really took place in history that are kind of the anchors of my story, I guess, in terms of the timeline. And they include, most notably, as I mentioned, the Roman invasion of Britannia, 43 AD, the Great Fire of Rome, 63-64 AD, and then the war in Judea, which Josephus, one of the great historians of the period, or referred to as the War of the Jews, that was 69-70 AD. And these characters whom I regard as having played, well, St. Paul and Yohanan, for example, who played such important roles in the creation of these identities that we refer to today as Judaism and Christianity, or our traditions or whatever you want to call it, religion, ethnicity, identity. These characters, I think their experience of the world was framed by these events. So I'm very, very much interested in seeing the world through the eyes of these characters and in the context of these events that were dramatic, tremendously dramatic events that they had to live through. To give an example, we're talking about the destruction of worlds with the Roman invasion of Britannia, with the Great Fire of Rome, and with the war in Judea in 69 to 70. That event, when the Great Temple of Jerusalem was destroyed, that is one of the very most significant events that created the context in which Jewish and Christian narratives, mythology, identity, the soil in which those cultures grew and out of which they grew, and also in the context of the Great Fire of Rome. I very much drew on real events, but I very much was interested in those events insofar as they were the source of the sources of these people's experience and of the cultures that grew out of those people's experiences.
It's really a fascinating distinction that you drew, Mitchell, between yours and Karen's work. Karen's being sort of an intimate portrayal of one woman or two women's lives, and yours is really sort of an epic novel that covers so many different characters from different cultures and different continents and really is grappling with a massive canvas. My assumption might be that the further back one goes in trying to render a portrayal of the past, the more difficult that task becomes. Would that be true or would that not? What do you think?
It opens possibilities and it also presents difficulties. Certainly, when you go very far back, sources are not as clear-cut, as well-defined, as well-understood, as abundant. My first novel, as you mentioned, took place in 15th century Spain. There were a lot of sources, but that was a different problem because a lot of the sources were written by inquisitors, and I'm writing about the Inquisition. So that's a different problem. In terms of the first century, the main sources, the main primary sources are Josephus, who does appear in my novel. He became a secretary to the Roman general Vespasian. And then there's the New Testament, neither of which claims to be unbiased, neither of which claims to be tell the complete story. And then there's all the other commentators and all the commentators about Roman culture from within Rome. And for me, it was a voyage of discovery. I like to read a whole lot of material and then just let it simmer in my mind. I don't even take notes. I don't take notes. And then what's important just distills out. And then I find out what the story is, who the characters are, and what's important about everything I've just read.
I'm Mitchell. I was just going to say the discussion of sources, it really makes a difference. So if you're working with a few sources and by the time, you know, the time that has elapsed, those sources are themselves famous, right? By sort of almost by definition, they're the only ones that we have left over. And so it tends to potentially, you tell me, but it might tend to when you're mulling all those things over, you end up incorporating their thoughts, them as characters or the events that they're most interested in, right? So rather than saying to yourself, I'm going to depart from that and imagine what the ordinary person might be feeling in this situation. By point of comparison, like with my research, we're talking about 1896. There's far more, sources. There are people who've written about that as secondary sources in all sorts of ways. And then the original documentation, like I, for instance, looked at a diary that was written by a woman named Emily Innes, who happened to live there at the time with her husband, who was, you know, working for the government. And so that source gave me sort of an insight of, here's someone there, a quote unquote regular woman from, you know, British woman at the time and her thoughts on the situation, as opposed to having to work through sort of the official historical record that has passed down through the ages, right? There's different access, I guess, to what was happening at the time.
What a gem that was to find that, Karen.
Yeah, it was. I hadn't found it in the beginning, but I thought, you know what, I should worked my way towards finding some of these sources, and they proved to be really helpful.
This makes me think of a question in terms of which accounts make it to the page, because if you're doing research and your sources are limited, or at least were written at a period of time where not every voice was represented, do you feel that fiction gives you an opportunity to balance that power a little bit, Mitchell?
Actually, I think, Karen and Pam, you've both posed related questions. I think the way I see it, after, let's say, I read the New Testament and reading all these epistles of Paul and learning a whole lot about the origins of Christianity, and that, all of that is fascinating itself to me. And also talking to scholars, I developed strong relationships, first on the intellectual level, literary level, and then at a personal level with scholars of this period in various places in the world. What happens for me is I get to know these characters. Like, let's just say that St. Paul. I felt like I got to know St. Paul. And what I wanted to do was not just to recreate what's already in the record about St. Paul, but really my interest is in filling in the shadows, filling out that character, making him come alive. For example, I figured out with the timeline and with talking with scholars that the real record of Paul, according to the New Testament, ends with Paul in jail, and it corresponds to the time of the Great Fire of Rome. And then he disappears. And then after that, there are legends. So part of my book is Paul in jail, and he's talking, and he's reflecting on his life. He's not telling us what we already know from the New Testament. He's telling us about his childhood in Tarsus and the cult of Mithra that was thriving in Tarsus at that time that bears so much resemblance to early Christianity. That's what I love, is taking this record, taking what we know about these characters, and then filling in the gaps and the shadows and trying to breathe life into the person.
That's great. Karen, in The Parasol Flower, the novel deals with imbalances, particularly between women and men, and that's by nature of the time in which it's set. But there is very much a feminist aspect to your novel. You're dealing with women in the arts and women trying to make a name for themselves or find a purpose for themselves. And even your contemporary character, Nancy, struggles in some ways with what her purpose is until she stumbles upon Hannah's story. But it is a very hopeful novel in terms of women finding their power. And would you like to speak to that?
Sure, of course. I'm glad that you said that it exists in both storylines, both for Hannah and for Nancy. So one of the things that I hope and I think is working well is that the reader can see at some point it kind of crystallizes like, wow, these people are in very, very different circumstances, these two women, and yet somehow they're in situations that they're, you know, not necessarily of their choosing, non-ideal, they're having to make choices where I guess men, but you know what, it's more diffuse than that. Society has sort of placed these inducements and constraints on them. I think what Nancy comes to figure out is that she can be empowered not just in the here and now, but through these relationships with others, including, of course, with Hannah, because she is getting to know who this woman is as an artist and to appreciate what she's created and, you know, sort of unraveling what's happened to that and finding her own path in the process rather than having to work within a system that wasn't working for her. So, and then Hannah again has a bit of a different path, but still trying to figure out, you know, who's supporting me, who's not, and how do I navigate that space so that I'm true to myself, which is always one of the most difficult questions to answer. So yes, I do think there are parallels, and I agree that it is hopeful because there are ways to make that journey and to make it your own. I would just also add that there's an aspect of the novel where there are these Malay women who are colonial subjects. So they're working as servants in these households. There is a storyline about how Hannah's friend, Eva, her name is, and her husband, Charles, they're evolutionary biologists, and they're doing field research, and they are taking the Malays as subject for their research. So those women are, again, in a particular position of being disempowered, right, through their society and the relationships that are occurring there. And so that's also going on, and it puts a context to the struggle that Hannah is enduring, right? So it's something sort of far more sinister, I guess we'd say, going on with the research that the Peterboroughs are undertaking and the loss of agency that these Malay women are experiencing is pretty stark. There's one character who sort of embodies that. Her name is Malu. So she is a servant in Eva and Charles's household, and she basically ends up sort of sticking up for herself at a certain point, but it's too late and it's not enough. And that sort of tragic storyline is a juxtaposition for the other two women who were following all the way along. So I think it's important to keep all of that in mind, that there are people who pay the costs, right, for others in a way. And I enjoyed being able to show all of that unfolding and keeping it all, sort of holding that all there so that the reader could see these trajectories. But yeah, point well taken. There is a feminist aspect to it. And I hope that that's my hope is that that's appreciated by people who are seeing these stories unfold.
Hannah's husband controls the money in the home and he reduces her allowance because he does not want her buying paints. And she very subversively decides to take matters in her own hands, and she takes her meager allowance and she decides she will go to market, which is not something that a woman of her stature would typically do. And she asks her housekeeper to teach her how to cook. And so she can squirrel away enough money to replenish her paint sources. And there are many points throughout the novel where women find ways to create their own power. And Hannah crosses boundaries too. She befriends the sergeant, who I believe is Malay. He's sort of her bodyguard initially, but they're friends too. And you've done a nice job of not making the women so powerless that the reader is not interested, if that makes sense.
Marvelous. Mitchell, you have some very strong female characters in your novel. Obviously, Aislinn drives the plot robustly in a magnificent manner, but also Poppaea, who is in a position of some power through marriage. Could you speak to the role of women in your novel?
Yes, and more generally to the role of power. And as I mentioned before, in the context of Roman Empire, power and subjugation, whether it's on the small scale of individuals or on the scale of whole nations. But certainly Aislinn, she's the sole survivor, as I mentioned, of her village. And rather than submit to powerlessness, utter, complete, total, bereft loss of everything she cares about, knows, loves, she has this crazy idea that she's going to get back at Rome and get vengeance for what has happened. So this begins the journey of the novel, which spans, as I mentioned, from Britannia to Rome to Judea. And that is her journey. And it's a journey from loss of everything, desire for vengeance, which comes right out of the Celtic lore that she has been exposed to earlier. And vengeance has a very different kind of resonance in that culture than in our culture. But anyway, desire for vengeance, hardscrabble existence in Rome, fighting for survival, and then learning about something else, learning about getting beyond bereavement and anger to something else, to, I guess, what we would say call religion, to finding a way to accept the state of the world and to find love in the world. And that's really her journey. I mean, I would say it is a journey of empowerment. It's more than one journey of empowerment, just in the person of Aislinn. As far as Poppaea goes, she's obviously a member of the ruling class in Rome. Oh, I had the amazing, amazing good fortune to visit her palace, which they've recently unearthed and excavated, and it's near Herculaneum. I forget the name of the town, but it's basically in a kind of a slum in a town in Italy, in the midst of all these old, rather modern high-rises that are not in the best shape. Then you've got this huge hole in the ground and you go down into Poppaea's palace. Anyway, she was a part of that ruling class in Rome that was decadent. She's conniving. She certainly knows how to use her feminine wiles, I guess you'd say, in a way that assures her own assertion of power. This is based on the historical record from Roman historians. Ending up marrying Nero, who was a madman, I can just tell you it doesn't turn out so well for Poppaea. But it's the same thing, I would say, when you're talking about powerlessness and trying to deal with a situation of utter powerlessness. This was the situation of the subjugated colonies of Rome. And it was a situation that Johann, my character, and St. Paul, my character, my Judean characters, they're dealing with this also. It's not just a matter of female powerlessness in a male world, although that is also one of the forms of powerlessness.
Yes. I wonder if either of you have a character that you felt acutely uncomfortable writing about. And I also wonder, Karen, what it felt like trying to write from the Malay perspective when we're talking about historical sources. Of course, Southeast Asia, a climate of humidity, the heat, the monsoon seasons, the damp, the rain, an environment which is seldom conducive to the preservation of historical documents. In drier regions, of course, where Mitchell may have been. So I'm just wondering how you write that perspective when so little survives of that particular experience in the voice of those particular individuals.
I was somewhat uncomfortable, actually. I'm just thinking if I was... I was uncomfortable in certain ways with other characters as well, but definitely with the Malay characters. I should say, I feel like a bit of a fraud here because I've not even been to Malaysia. So all of my research and everything was around and sort of pinned on the hope that I could be convincing as a novelist to the extent that I haven't been there. I haven't lived there. I don't have any good Malaysian friends who are telling me about it. So really, it's a dicey operation when you're coming from outside and you're placing your storyline and your characters in a place that is not, I don't have a personal connection to it. I should say, we asked about sort of what's the source of inspiration at the beginning, and I don't think Mitchell and I actually answered the part B of your question, but I was inspired to write The Parasol Flower based on scholarly research that I was doing. So I was looking at academic texts about colonial subjugation in Southeast Asia. And I'd read a couple of books by a woman named Laura Ann Stoller. And my focus was around looking at history through the lens of Michel Foucault and others who were reading Foucault. And I just loved what she had done with that. She was writing about intimate relationships in a colonial situation where you have multiple races and, you know, the politics as they were at the time. And I kind of made a mental note and I said, this is wonderful stuff for academia and for essay writing, but we're talking about intimate relationships and I think it needs a story. I think it needs to be told through the eyes of these characters and with feelings and emotion and not sort of the abstract kind of, you know, that you get in academic texts, a much more sort of dry, abstract operation. And I was propelled from that abstract place into imagining viscerally what this place would be like, you know, for different people who are living there. And so, yes, at a certain point, I was faced with a choice. Like I could have chosen to only tell the story through the eyes of Hannah, right? Through the British subject who is there. And maybe her husband, because I do have part of the book is through George's point of view. And I sort of asked myself, is that a better approach? Is that actually safer? What makes me think that I know what George in 1890 would be thinking and feeling versus what a Malay person in 1890 would be thinking and feeling? And what assumptions am I making with that? And what am I actually familiar with the Victorian era in England? I mean, I did a lot of research about that as well in terms of what was happening in England at the time. And I decided one of the main characters should be someone who's Malay. And yet, of course, it was with trepidation because I actually was working with a writing coach at the time who had this moment where she said to me, this is really, you know, maybe you shouldn't be taking this on because you don't want people to read this and say you're imposing your own white colonial view on the situation and not being sensitive enough to sort of give voice to the Malay experience. And we had many discussions around that, actually. And I ended up saying, okay, I'm going to take the chance. I don't know how else to write this book because I want this character's experiences, her emotional experiences, to be part of it in a rich way. So what I did was I read against the grain for, you know, through my sources. So I mentioned Emily Innes, for instance, her diary. And when she was living there, you know, she had her own take on the natives that she was in contact with. And it was formed from her experiences in the late 19th century as a Victorian woman with certain expectations, et cetera, et cetera. It's interesting how you can do that. You can sort of see through someone's point of view and yet abstract from it and go, here's their own cultural milieu that's informing their perspective. I could see refracted through something like Emily Innes's diary, you know, what was actually happening or what I thought was actually happening in those exchanges between her and her native servants. And then it's in a matter of accumulating quite a number of sources, you see certain patterns and you see you're able to, in a way, ascertain within those sources what is the voice that isn't being heard and kind of read between the lines or in the margins and imagine an alternate way of expressing those events. So that said, no, I didn't access like Malay sources written in Malaysian or you know, anything like that. I was unable, really ill-equipped to do that. So I used my imagination when it came to, you know, what would this 14-year-old girl in this situation feel? What would she expect? What would her parents, her family, her community expect of her? How might she be interacting with these people who she knows she's not entitled to object to, right? So it was very difficult and very tricky, and I still feel I understand. I guess I understand if someone would object to that and want to criticize me for taking that on and doing that. But at the same time, it's a really thorny issue to say, look, you can only speak from your own personal identity and experiences. Once we go down that road, there's not a lot left for fiction. So if you're saying, look, I'm, you know, here's who I am, and I can only speak for myself, I can't inhabit anyone else's world or life or place and time, There's not a lot left to say, at least for me, because I haven't lived a life which would be worth writing about particularly.
Well, I have to say, Karen, I agree with you that having Malu's point of view in the novel was important. It touches back on our question about power and balancing power. Without her point of view, the Malay people really would have had no voice in the novel other than as subjects. So I think it was, yes, it was brave to include her point of view, but also necessary.
Great point, Pam. Mm-hmm. Mitchell, do you have any characters that come to mind that made you uncomfortable rendering them?
I would say probably Vespasian is the first one that comes to mind, because this is a man who, from my perspective, if I were to make a judgment about him based on my values today, he's a very brutal guy, and he did some horrible things. And I wanted to get inside his head and see it from his point of view. And I did the same thing in my previous novel with the Inquisitor Thomas de Torquemada. And some people said, well, I don't understand why you didn't just make him the villain. But I want to see everyone's point of view. And Vespasian, for me, was a fascinating character. At the same time that he was a Roman emperor and a great military leader, and he had all of the negatives that are associated with those roles from the point of view of the contemporary value system. At the same time, people who are admirers of ancient Rome will tell you, you know, he's a great emperor who restored Rome following the degeneracy of the Caesars, you know, that is to say of the heirs and the adopted heirs and so forth of Julius Caesar. And the Caesars just became progressively degenerate, until you get to Vespasian, who's not a Caesar, who doesn't come from the patrician class, and who has this nostalgia for what he called the republican virtues, the virtues of the time prior to empire. Those virtues in his mind were decency, honor, strength, religion, honoring the gods. And so he did that. He lived that. He did restore the power and the might and the glory of Rome in a time, from a time of tremendous decline. Vespasian, so yeah, was I uncomfortable? I wouldn't say I was uncomfortable. I would say that I was intrigued and fascinated at this multifaceted character whose values are very different from mine. But once I got into his head, I could understand and appreciate where he was coming from.
I think that's what makes for a great work of fiction, historical or otherwise, is the author's ability to empathize with all of the characters without making one a total villain or without making another a saint. It's just that it's a human story and humans are fallible. And so I think that it's important to render that on the page.
Yes, I almost am embarrassed to say I understand his point of view, and I totally feel for him, because he himself had a difficult life in many ways, you know? And I go into that in my book, I mean, his competition with his brother and all of the issues he had with Nero and so forth. He had to prove something, and he did.
Which, of course, is critical to writing him with depth and a certain compassion.
Yeah, every character has all these dimensions that you can pass judgment on, but in fact, they're due to their experience, they're due to their genetics, whatever. But you're right, I totally agree, not just historical novels. Really, in my opinion, if an author can't get into the hearts of his characters, I'm not really interested in reading that book.
I'm wondering, many early historical novels played an important role in evoking an appreciation for the past, particularly in readers who perhaps are not inclined toward reading history or dry historical tomes. Victor Hugo's The Hunchback of Notre Dame, for example, is often credited for fueling the movement to preserve Gothic architecture in France. And indeed, he began writing the work largely to make his contemporaries aware of the value of Gothic architecture, which was being neglected, defaced, or demolished to make way for new buildings. And I'm wondering, what do you think the role of a historical fiction novelist might be in regards to promoting an appreciation of the past, or perhaps even an awareness of the past? Karen?
Good question. You know, I think what these books can do is put people in the past imaginatively, you know, and in doing that, that's something that, you know, the novel does better than any other medium, as far as I can see. So I think, you know, if you're there inhabiting that space imaginatively, your appreciation for it can be quite rich, as opposed to being told something in a textbook, for instance, or, you know, a documentary film. These venues are also good, but when you're able to have these characters in your mind, in your body almost, and you're ingesting all of this through a novel, you're living through it in a way that you maybe aren't when you have you're encountering history in those other ways. So I think that's the strength of the novel, really, that's allowing us to inhabit those spaces. And it's just in this case we're choosing to go to, you know, 1896 and Malaysia, or, you know, to Rome, or to wherever the story is taking place. But that's something I wonder about readers. You know, are they interested in the history and therefore they turn to the novel set in those places and times, or is it not necessarily about the history? They want a really good story, and they, you know, and it happens to take place, you know, 100 years ago or, you know, 800 or whatever. And I mean, I'll throw that open to everybody. I'm not sure. I myself don't, as a reader, I don't seek out, you know, all the stories I can find about, I don't know, pick a place in time, right? Like 1920s or something. I don't operate that way. But I'm not sure if others do.
I find that really interesting, where writers of historical fiction are writing about the past, but they often describe the past in such a way with some subtlety and some deftness of hand that illuminates issues that are very contemporary in their nature, as we've talked about with your novel, Karen, and women's empowerment, and Mitchell with religious divisiveness and the roots of that. And I think that's rather a fascinating exploration. Is it, do you think, a deliberate one, or one that just manifests itself in that process of research and writing?
There's a great quote from James Baldwin: "History is not the past, it is the present." And I couldn't agree more. We are our history. And when I'm writing about these narrative traditions, the crucible in which our identity was formed, not only our identities as Christians, Jews, whatever, but also, I believe, we're still living in the Roman Empire, very, very much so. So much of the structure of our world today derives from that time. So we still have it, to be ignorant of it, to not have a sense of what it is, not just what it was, but what it still is to not know where we are. It's to not know where we are, in not just in cultural and political history, but in the universe. That's my sense. So an awareness of the past is an awareness of the present. I guess it's a kind of archaeology that, to me, speaks very much about where we come from and maybe even about why we're here.
So for you, Mitchell, do you, when you set out then to write about, like in this book, for instance, was there an interest related to the present that spurred you? So you thought, you know, people are not realizing that we are Roman in so many ways, so I'm going to cast some light on that and take them there. And so your motivation, or your frame, I guess, for building the story is related to the present? Or is it more just, you're saying, a more general thing, like the past lives in us always, and there are many ways in which we can recognize that?
First of all, I'm really too ignorant. I was too ignorant at the beginning of this journey to be able to make any kind of assertion about what I would discover. You know, like, for example, we're living in the Roman Empire. I didn't even know enough about Rome at that point in my life to make that kind of statement. But I will say that I guess you could say, not to sound egocentric, but it's a kind of self-exploration. But when I use that word self, I'm not just talking about me. I'm talking about us. I did not have a specific idea where this journey would take me, but I did have a sense that I needed to know, that I needed to know. For example, there was a specific question. I must admit, there was a specific question. And when I was writing my first novel, it takes place in the 15th century, in the context of this world that's falling apart, where Christianity, Judaism, and Islam were all cohabiting the Iberian Peninsula, and then that world falls apart. That was the context of my first novel. And while I was writing it, this question came about in my mind, which is, where did Christianity and Judaism diverge? Because I've got these characters in my novel, in my first novel, who are very, very knowledgeable about the history of Judaism and of Christianity from the point of view of their 15th century scholarship. And they believe from that point of view that these are extremely different religions. But from our 20th century point of view, these religions are variants of really one religion. I was really dying with hunger to figure out, well, what the hell happened? How did these two religions become not only separate, but antithetical to a point where they're like killing each other? I guess I would say, yeah, that was the initial question. But I feel obviously that question repercusses in our own day, in my own lifetime.
I would love it if each of you might read a section from your own work.
Sure. I'll read a section. This is from chapter 14, which it's a festival that's going on in the village where they live, or the town Kuala Kangsa. Actually, the entire chapter, the first half of it is written from Hannah's point of view and the second from George's, her husband. And that's one of the things I quite enjoyed about it, because he's sort of a miserable guy. And so it's it's interesting to take that same sort of festive space and then twist it and see his grumpy thoughts about it. The context is that George has basically told her to stop painting because there's been a tiger that's attacked and killed their cow. And so he's saying it's unsafe for you to go into the jungle and paint, so you have to stop doing that. And he has also launched his own mission to find this man-eating tiger. And so he's hired people to go on a tiger hunt. So the festival itself, the Gymkhana Festival, is Hannah's showing up to take her place at the baked goods table. She's part of the Ladies' Association, and they're there in their capacity, as is the rest of the village. So it's a colorful spot to land at here. Like the rest of the village, Hannah is in a bright mood as she weaves her way up the sloping parade ground to the Lap baked goods table. Chastened by her encounter with Lucy and Hazel at the post office, she has volunteered for two shifts this year. Around her, Malays are strolling in sisterly chains, their colorful headscarves floating on the breeze behind them. A family of Dutch homesteaders are laughing at each other as they attempt the apple bobbing. She makes a large detour around a queue of Chinese women and children waiting for the egg toss. Two English officers, she remembers their faces but not their names, strut through this same commotion in uniform, looking like smug peacocks. They are heading for the racetrack, she supposes, where the colonel will be found. She herself will not spend a penny that day, not even on a kebab, she tells herself. Their spicy, meaty scent seems to be following her, making her mouth water. Her measures of austerity brought her through to the next installment of her stipend, from which she has promptly removed payment for an order for Schlauerbox. A reduced order, but an order nonetheless. Knowing that 7 tubes of paint and 20 meters of canvas were making their way from France is as gratifying as anything she could enjoy at the festival. Is it going well then? Hannah says as she reaches the lap table. The location is good this year. No, it's not. We're well out of the way up here, grumbles the lady manning the table, Myrtle someone or other. A flushed, porcine woman, she is married to the bank manager. The view is inspiring. But they're not going to trudge all the way up here for the view, are they? I suppose that's why we have the baked goods. Hannah moves in around the tables, assuming her place in the second empty chair. Such a lovely breeze, too. Myrtle is so overheated that droplets are forming on her temples. Did you not bring any baking? No, Hannah admits. She'd not wanted to squander pantry ingredients, but this decision seems churlish and wrong now that she sees how generously the others have donated. I'm afraid my upside-down cake fell flat, she fibs. Myrtle peers at her skeptically. Hannah turns to check the roster, hoping Myrtle is about to head off shift. No such luck. When she looks up again, she sees the crumpled hat coming nearer through the crowd. Soon, the Peterborough woman is standing across from them at the baked goods table, hand in hand with a girl of about 10. Behind them, a light-skinned Malay servant waits. Hannah greets the mother and daughter warmly, giving a brief tour of the goods on offer. I'm Eva Peterborough, the woman interrupts her. Oh, yes, I know, Hannah laughs nervously, though I didn't know you had a daughter. The gossip mill failed to report that I have a daughter? Myrtle snorts. Well, it's probably not, allows Hannah. I just don't take much notice of gossip. Eva's mouth crooks into something resembling a smile. You're telling the truth, aren't you? This is my daughter, Charlotte. Charlotte, this is Mrs. Inglis, the artist. Charlotte looks much like her mother, though shorter and somewhat fairer. She nods politely and they exchange greetings. She's lovely, Hannah says to Eva. Exactly how the lady knows who she is, the artist, is that owing to the same gossip mill? The Peterboroughs order two plates of various squares and biscuits and two slabs of fruitcake. Myrtle, recording the tally on a clipboard, brightens considerably. I think you should know, Eva says, as she and Hannah come together over the fruitcake, that Lucy Finch has just cautioned me against you. Why? What do you mean, cautioned you? Just what I said. They confirm that Myrtle is busy dispensing cups of lemonade to Charlotte and her girl. I'm not sure of her purpose, Eva squints. I believe the charge was fraternizing in the public gardens with an undesirable. What? Good grief, Hannah exclaims. Lucy, or one of her spies, must have seen her with Sergeant Singh. We were discussing, it doesn't matter, Sergeant Singh works for me, or rather he used to, when I painted in the jungle. It's a false characterization in more ways than one, that anybody should be cautioned against her, and that Mrs. Peterborough should confide in her about it. Don't worry, darling, says Eva. I understand completely. She stands chewing a macaroon for a few moments longer before bidding Hannah goodbye. Well, that was very odd, Hannah says to herself. She's an odd duck, if nothing else, Myrtle mops her brow as the Peterboroughs disappear into the shifting crowds below. I'm surprised they came into town today to fraternize with the hoi polloi. What is that? Hannah points. At the corner of the parade ground, a party of servants is struggling over something massive. What on earth are they hauling between them? She strains to see as onlookers crowd in. The little mob moves slowly across the field. Others rush across the grounds toward them. Hannah comes around the table. That's not a game. I don't think that's part of the festival. Mrs. Inglis, calls Myrtle. Where are you going? You're on shift. She wanders down the lawn, sidestepping darting children and their ayahs pursuing in fluttering sarongs. The newcomers at the center of the melee are natives. Their miners' jumpsuits are rolled down and down their waists and bamboo poles are yoked to their bare shoulders. Hannah stumbles and falls into a horseshoe pit. It's George's tiger, she says, righting herself. Back on her feet, she continues down the slope. The majestic cat is upside down, bound by its legs to the crossed poles. It is large enough and the men short enough that the back of the body is dragging against the scrubby grass as they travel. As Hannah nears, she sees that one of the arm bones protrudes near the shoulder. The surrounding flesh looks to have been hacked at. Even at this state, the fur, a warm apricot brown with strokes of jet black, appears exquisitely sumptuous. Instinctively, she puts out her hand. Is this for Sahib Colonel? She calls to them. Some in the crowd move aside as she nears. The hunters do not turn or break stride. The weight must be staggering. She runs to the head of the party and catches a glimpse of the beast's sympathetic countenance, dead, riddled with bullets. The crowd forming around the tiger and its hunters causes them to slow and finally stop. Malays and Chinese and Europeans alike are poking and pinching and jeering at the carcass. Two men lift the great muzzle by the lips, exposing the fangs. They drop the head back down with a crack. Hannah becomes aware of the flies buzzing over the body, especially at the anus and along a gaping wound on one flank. When the breeze shifts direction, forcing a metallic, wet fur stench upon her, she clamps a hand over her nose and mouth. Eva Peterborough, she notices, is watching farther up the slope. Please, Hannah says to the men, raising her voice even louder, are you bringing this animal to Sahib Colonel Inglis? One of the miners, struggling to keep his footing near the beast's head, looks up at her. Then I'll fetch him. I'll fetch you the colonel. Just stop trying to move the poor thing. And she shouts, and the rest of you, go away. Leave it alone. This animal is not your property. Swallowing her disgust, Hannah turns and runs.
Beautiful.
Mitchell, do you have a passage you'd like to read?
Sure. So first I'd like to introduce it, if I may, briefly. On one level, my book is about storytelling. And when I talk about narrative traditions and identities, I'm talking about storytelling. And within that context, there are elements of fantasy in my book, as well as real characters and real events. And these elements come from competing religions, narratives, competing cultures, stories. So the passage I'm going to read right now deals with Aislinn when she's a young girl toward the beginning of my book. She has been raised by her aunt, and one of the things that bonds her with her aunt is her aunt's storytelling. But her aunt has been telling her that just wait until the bard comes around. There's a bard who travels through the countryside and tells much better stories than mine, her aunt tells her. One day, Aislinn's lamb disappears, and Aislinn is gone for a few days. And when she comes back, her aunt is angry with her because of her disappearance. And I'm going to start right there. As punishment for your disappearance, her aunt tells her when she returns home, you're to drink the tears we shed during your absence. Aislinn sips tentatively from the glazed clay cup painted with garlands and flowers. Mergil, her aunt, tilts the vessel up and tears spill into Aislinn's mouth, onto her chin. The salty tears of her younger sister, the sour tears of her deceased mother's sister, the muddy tears of the potter's nephew. You are fortunate you came back in time, Mergil tells her. We have a visitor. Wash in the stream, dress in your best lane and brat. The bard who has appeared at their gate, a huge man with a wild beard and untamed hair, is dressed in a yellow lane and a plum-covered outer garment. All 67 villagers gather around him as he raises his hands and lowers them in a circular motion, creating an airy orb in which his characters will dwell while his words breathe life into them. Greetings from the court of King Togodumnus, he thunders, and the elders, together with their children and their children's children, listen captivated as he embarks upon a long, convoluted tale of warriors wandering, curses acquired and shed like ill-fitting garments, and princesses' hearts bursting with sadness and gratitude. He speaks of a wild man who hoards balms of healing, of a heartbroken knight who has forged a pact with the companions, only to discover that he has been cheated, of a spinster who after her death contrives to burn down the castle of the prince who has spurned her. As the sun sets and a storm brews, the bard sits on a boulder, reels in the far-flung fibers of his story, and knots them into a loose net that traps his listeners' imaginations. Our lives are nothing but tales, my friends, he concludes, interlocking yarns that form a great epic whose outer edges we can never behold. Like all good stories, our lives twist and turn. You think it's about this, but then it's about that. Trails appear to lead one way, but take you somewhere else. Patterns shift under our gaze like a stick on a bush that moves and becomes an insect. At night, look up at the heavens, look at the constellations, the legends they relate, and consider this, another girl, another boy, 1,000 days journey distant, is gazing up at those same stars. They are telling him and her stories too, not the same stories, entirely different ones, but they are the same stars. He waves toward the horizon. I must warn you. You will slog through many a muddy field before you happen upon the open green landscape that causes your heart to soar. And I shall not hide it from you. You will see much tumult. Battles will be won and lost. Loved ones will die and others be born. The sun may turn black, but even in that murk, if you keep your eyes open, you will discern a glimmer. He lowers his voice. Always keep in mind, the verities of the heart are the center around which all revolves. Although he has spoken these words 100 times, he infuses them with such quiet, intimate passion that they sparkle like flecks of gold in a rushing stream. He possesses the ability to look all the children in the eyes at once. And now I defer to you to bring this magical afternoon we have spent together to a suitable conclusion. Form a circle around that tree yonder and thank our companions for the inscrutable wonders of this existence that the universe has bequeathed to us for no reason we can hope to learn. The children spread out under the gnarled, weeping trunk of the great yew, their hair unfurled, their faces upturned to the sky, and chant a prayer. Rain falls crimson in the sunset. Lightning streaks their eyes.
Wow, magnificent. Thank you, Mitchell.
Thank you, Jane.
It's been a great conversation. We could do many more of these. This conversation could go on and on. Thank you both for your time, for taking time out of your day to talk with us about your novels, to read to our listeners, because I think it's so important for them to hear the author's work from their own voices. So thank you. Thank you both for sharing.
I'd like to remind our listeners also that The Parasol Flower is available for pre-order on our website, www.regalhousepublishing.com, as is Mitchell James Kaplan's book, Into the Unbounded Night. The very best way to support an indie press is to buy books directly from their website, and we're very grateful for your support. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving us a review. We'd love to hear from you. And we hope you'll join us for our next episode on A Conspiracy of Lemurs, The Lasting Influence of the Plague, Writing About Human Vulnerability, with Jan Alexander and Mandy Suzanne Wong. From all of us at Regal, keep reading.